Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 125 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. My name is Mike, that is Gavin, and that is Fia. And friends, what are you guys thankful for?
Well, I'm thankful for a lot of things. I'm thankful that, we just bought a house, although as it turns out, the house isn't necessarily the expensive part. It's all the other stuff you have to do with the house.
Starting off real boring here, Gavin.
But no, I'm thankful for you know, the typical stuff, friends, family, whatever. The podcast.
Aww. Fia, give me something better than that. Friends, family, my hat. Like, come on.
I'm
give
thankful me something better for than that. Hugs and okay. Pecan pie, which I get brutally harassed for calling it pecan and not pecan.
No, that's correct.
This is what happens when you go to the South. Like,
yeah.
South is a different planet, man.
Like, it's correct to say it that way. It's not correct to enjoy it, though.
Right. Right.
You know what I'm thankful for?
What are you thankful for?
Is that I've tried as hard as I could to not turn on my heat until Thanksgiving. And then my house got down to 49 degrees before Thanksgiving. And because I wanted something to be thankful for. I try not to turn on my heat until Thanksgiving so that I have something to be thankful for.
Aww, that's
and sweet. Even though I failed and I had to turn on my heat before Thanksgiving because my house got to 49 degrees, I'm thankful for the fact that I can sit in my house in Syracuse, New York and be like, yeah, this is fine. I feel rather comfortable.
Okay, but
that's what I'm thankful for.
If you ask, I'd say most people. Is 49 degrees in your house comfortable? They would say no.
No. So once it got to 49 degrees, I then turned the heat on into the 60s. I forgot what I had set at.
All right.
But like, you know, so now it's not there. Because, boy, for a while there, when it was in the mid-50s, low 50s, like, wasn't comfortable at all just existing in this house. My best part of the day was the shower because there was heat.
Aww.
Oh, it's rough, and that's why I do that, right. So I have something to be thankful for.
You know, that not friends or family or anything, just, no. You know.
No, absolutely not. You people are lucky to have me.
Thanks, Mike.
It is heat that I am thankful for. It's wonderful to see you guys, as well as nice to be back here with the listeners after taking last week off.
Yeah.
Yep. Hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we did. We had a pretty nice Thanksgiving. Liz and I went up and saw my parents and saw my two nieces and my grandparents and stuff. So it was good trip all around. But yeah, a little behind the curtain action here. All three of us kind of forgot last week.
Yeah.
I was on vacation. My university is kind enough to, without using vacation days, they just give us the whole week of Thanksgiving off. And so I was in full vacation mode. I definitely thought that day was Sunday. And then, like, our usual recording time rolled around. And someone was like, hey, are we doing this? And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
No. Oh, no, it wasn't even Monday. It was Tuesday. It was the next day.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Fia was like, hey, we forgot to record last night. And we were just like, oh, well, I don't really want to do it today. Let's just do it next week.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
That was pretty much it. Which is not a good habit that we shouldn't get into a habit of that. But it's a holiday. What can we say?
We can be thankful for the holiday and the flexibility of our podcast schedule.
Exactly. But yeah. So today, as an episode that ends in a 5 or 0, it is not one of my episodes. It is a Fia or Mike episode. And this time it is a Fia episode. And, you know, before we get into all of that, though. Mike, do you have a today in history for us? Oh, wait a minute. Before that, housekeeping. I suppose I should keep house because it's a Fia episode.
Why not?
So do not forget to rate the show on whatever platform you listen to us on and to follow us on our various social medias, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube, and to give us feedback on the show and suggest any future topics you might like to hear on the show. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, we do have a Google form down in the show notes. Which you can fill out and tell us a little bit about yourself and see if you'd be a good fit to have on the show as a guest. And for next episode, we will be continuing our march through geologic time, talking about all the different time periods. The last one we did was the Cretaceous period, a good, you know, couple months ago at this point. So we ended it with, you know, the dinosaurs besides birds going extinct. And now we're going to be picking up the pieces in the Paleocene epoch.
Cool.
In the time, sort of, in the while the dust from the asteroid was settling. So that's what we're going to be talking about in our next episode in 2 weeks.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and with the house kept, now, hopefully that gave you a little bit of lead time, Mike, if you didn't have a today in history.
How dare you? How dare you?
Am I wrong?
Statistically speaking.
Right.
We're throwing statistics out here now?
It's a science podcast, so yeah.
Anyway, go ahead,
well,
Mike.
I don't know. Now I'm not sure I want to do today in history. But I will anyways. So, in 1972, we have Pong released.
Ooh.
November 29th, 1972. Pong is released, the first commercially successful video game. There was a cool video I saw about, like, what was the actual world's first video game, and, like, that question is surprisingly difficult to answer.
Yeah.
But, like, the first, like, commercially successful, like, you know, nobody doubts it, anyone, you know, everyone heard of it video game, Pong, mm-hmm. released today in 1972.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's all I got.
Could you explain what that game is for some people that may not know?
Yeah.
Take it away, Gavin.
Yeah, so Pong is, there's a single pixel. It's basically like very simple video game ping pong. So there's a little pixel that bounces back and forth, and you have just a wheel that you turn in one way or another to slide your paddle, basically, to block the pixel from going past your paddle. Cool. Almost like a hockey goalie or like a foosball goalie almost.
Yeah.
And so it just bounces back and forth. And I believe, I don't know if this was the case originally, I believe over time, the longer it goes without scoring, it speeds up. I don't know whether that was the case in the original Pong. I know I've played it at like arcades and stuff, and that's the case whenever you play Pong for the most part these days. But yeah, that was pretty much just it. That was the entire game, was one sort of square of pixels that bounced back and forth, and then two blocks of white pixels on like one on either side, and you just sort of turned a dial, basically, not even like a wheel or a joystick or anything. It was just like a dial that you turned one way to move it to the left and the other way to move it to the right, and that was the whole game.
Cool.
It's surprisingly fun and kind of difficult. Because we're so, at least myself, as someone who plays a lot of video games, it's surprisingly difficult because of how simple it is, almost. Like, you expect it to move faster, or you expect, like, the paddle to be a little more responsive to you moving, that you kind of, you don't adjust for it. It's an interesting game to play in almost 2024.
Awesome.
And, this week, because it is a FIA episode, we do not have a seagrass corner, but I'm going to hit you with some hard and fast paleontology news. So, a few weeks ago, there was a study published about a really unusual group of animals that we don't really get good fossils of, and that are, they are lampreys.
Ooh, the demons.
Yes. Lampreys, if you are not familiar, are more or less giant leeches, but they're not leeches. Like, leeches are worms. They're segmented worms, just like earthworms. Lampreys function in their environment a lot like a leech, at least the ones that are the most familiar to people, that they just latch onto the side of a fish and basically suck its blood. However, it's not a worm, it is a fish. Specifically a jawless fish. So these are a really, really ancient group of vertebrates. So they don't really have bones. They have a mouth, but no jaws. They just have a hole at the front of their face that has not quite true teeth, because they're not made out of dentin and enamel and bone like our teeth are. They're made out of keratin. So they're much more like horns or little fingernails than they are, you know, teeth, or even like teeth that you would see in like a fish, like a bony fish. So lampreys, there are ones that don't do this. There are some that are predatory or some that are, you know, not parasitic, but that is sort of the typical how people think of lampreys. And so, as you can imagine, they are not very common as fossils because they don't really have hard parts.
Right.
However, there was a really phenomenal fossil site, which is was a previously known site, I believe, in China, but it was from the from the Jurassic Yanliao biota. So we're not going quite as far back as they probably existed. These things were probably around in the Cambrian and the Ordovician period, around the time where complex multicellular life was really starting to take off. So this was in the Jurassic period, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of, you know, between 200 and 160 million or 120 million years ago or so. And these guys were not just small. Many lamprey species are pretty small. I think the longest one around today is a couple of feet. Most of them, most of the species that are around today are rather small, only a few inches. However, this one that was found, or one of the ones that was found, was basically a complete body fossil, which is already just amazing.
Yeah, that's crazy. I was thinking it was just going to be the teeth.
Yeah, that's what you would expect, but it's almost like, because I said, it's basically just pure keratin. It's basically just sort of like a rhino horn, which is also quite misleading because you'll see fossil reconstructions of extinct rhinos with their horns, but we don't have fossil rhino horns. They don't preserve. And so this guy is pretty much complete and is over 2 feet long.
Wow.
So it's the largest fossil lamprey ever found. And a big sort of debate with these guys, lampreys in general, is being parasitic sort of the default? Or is that something that a few groups did along the way? And so that's been really hard to tell because we don't have good fossils. And so, luckily, the whole feeding structure of this lamprey was preserved. And it pretty much just looks like almost like a little bit of a hybrid. It seems like it can, it resembles the mouth structure, even though it's sort of the size of some of the more parasitic ones. I think the largest lamprey today is about 2 feet long and is parasitic. Its feeding structure resembles a lot more of the sort of flesh-eating ones that have really strong, powerful jaws to be hunting things. So it's quite interesting. That is kind of not what people thought might have been the case. But a cool weirdo group of animals leaving some cool weirdo group of fossils. It also is unique in that it was from what would have been the Southern Hemisphere at the time. And I believe this was our only lamprey fossils from the Southern Hemisphere. They almost exclusively today live in the Northern Hemisphere. So this also was kind of surprising. So, yeah. Cool lamprey things. And I figured that would sort of segue us a little bit with some marine stuff into talk about some seagrass.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you for that, Gavin.
Then I guess with our Today in History and our housekeeping and our paleontology news taken care of, what are we learning about today, Via?
Right. It's a very free-form episode this week. We're going to kind of talk about what grad school is like, what being a marine biologist is like, and what being a PhD student is. And I want to start
Yeah, because we sort of talked about grad school a bit. You know, that's something that, right, even though it's in different fields, all three of us have experience with.
Some more than others.
Well, yes. But hey, you went to grad school. It was just, you know, very different from my grad school or Fia's grad school.
Right. Yes.
But yeah. And but now you're taking it a step further in the other, more different grad school.
Yeah. And I wanted to start off by asking both of you what it is you think that I do. And it's not, there's no right or wrong answer. It's just to start a conversation of marine biology and PhD life, I guess. So, Mike first. What do you think I do?
I think that you spend like 40% of your time in the field doing some sort of experiments. Like, I know you were out quite a bit when you were in Louisiana, in the swamp. I have no idea what those experiments entail, but like actually getting your hands dirty. And then 60% of your time either sitting in classes or writing papers or teaching or TAing, like, and kind of getting a more, you know, kind of traditional formalized education. That's kind of my understanding of particularly science-y, you know, advanced degree programs. Yeah, that's what I'm going to go with, like a 60-40 split.
Cool. And do you know the general research that I'm doing?
No, not at all.
Okay, perfect. That's okay. Gavin?
No, I think Mike hit it pretty well on the head. I think, at least for your experience up to this point, you know, I remember in one past episode, or maybe it was just us just talking, I think you, a lot of your research involved like collecting invertebrates with like a giant hose or like vacuum thing.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yes. Yep. The suction sampler.
Yeah, that. And you had to figure out like a grate or something to put over it to make sure like too much wasn't sucked up.
Right. Yeah.
And then you had to sort of count, you know, how much of what critter got sucked up, and identifying all the different little critters and seeing what that tells you about the environment. Is that at least your master's, how I understood it?
Yeah, you did great. That was definitely a full chapter of what I did.
Cool. And then your PhD, I know you're working with seagrass, and I think you're doing something more similar. And I remember sponges being thrown around in there.
Yes.
As well.
Yep. Yep. Cool. Well, that is always very eye-opening to ask people what I do. So thank you guys for that. Most of what you said is pretty spot on. I would say that Mike's,
go ahead, say that I'm less on point.
I was going to say your percentages are off. I would say that in marine ecology, generally speaking, this can vary, but in my experience, we're doing about 10% field work and then like 30% lab work. And then 60% writing. So, like, it is technically, if you want to bundle it up, 40%, like, field and lab. But I would say being out, like, in the ocean, maybe, like, a couple, like, of, I think for my master's, it was a total of 2 weeks, maybe. That was the entirety of my master's fieldwork, and then the rest I was like in the lab and writing.
Yeah, I feel like go ahead, Mike.
I was just gonna say, so being in the lab and being in the field are kind of two different, you know, they're so different, they, you know, shouldn't be put together in the same category.
Yes, because like I don't know, I think like visually it's more appealing to say, oh, I do 40% field work, but in reality, like you're out,
you gotta have a lot of money for that.
Yeah, you're out in the water for a short period of time, and then like almost three times as much of your field time, you're like in a closed room with a light shining down, and you're just staring at like organisms and samples and weighing things, and it's very repetitive and kind of not something that people would, I guess, find like the glamorous side of marine biology, if you will.
That is definitely a very similar vibe to paleontology.
Yeah.
Because everyone imagines like the beginning of Jurassic Park, where you're out in the desert or something and you're just laying on your belly, scraping at stuff on the ground. And like, yeah, that does happen. And that's probably the most exciting part. But easily, at least I think the proportions are, you know, quite a bit different in paleontology for field time to lab time, in that it takes like, for every hour you spend on something in the field, it can take like 10 hours of prep work once you get it back to the lab.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then it's a matter of writing it up, and then the whole publication process, which I can't really speak to myself. I've never published a paper.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
But yeah, so definitely similar vibes if, you know, the percentages are a little different between, you know, us two.
Right. And just going back to what other people think I do, I wanted to kind of bring up, like, what my parents think that I do.
That's always fun.
Yeah.
I was just about to say that. What?
Yeah. Like, essentially, my mom really tries. She really tries to keep up and understand what I'm doing. But I still think that she thinks that I'm doing a lot more, like, being in the ocean and snorkeling around and having a fun, grand old time. And same with my dad, too. Whereas, like almost all of my weeks look at me, like, it's just me sitting at a computer for 8 to 10 hours a day. They kind of think that I am just playing around in the ocean. My grandma used to think that I was, when I was doing a different project on land crabs, she thought that I was trying to save the crabs, and I was essentially like being some sort of savior to them when I was just counting holes.
That's really cute.
Yeah, it was very, very cute. She wrote like a yearly update letter to all of her friends and family, and like just was like and like mentioned like highlights of like her grandchildren and what they're doing, and she was like, and Fia's in Louisiana saving the crabs and doing this and stuff, and I was like, oh my gosh.
That's this really is sweet.
So inaccurate, but so sweet. Yeah. Another perspective, I guess, is what fishermen or sportsmen think that I do. And that is a range of spectrum. You know, it can vary from people thinking that, you know, I'm doing, you know, research to inform decision making, or that I'm just spending a bunch of government money for fun. Yep. It's very varying, but it seems like the culture that is around where I'm working now, the community is very actively involved in the science, and that creates a much better relationship to get research done there.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so then what I really do is I sit... Oh, wait, I wanted to add one more. What my boyfriend Andy thinks I do.
What does your boyfriend Andy do?
He is a engineer.
Okay, so not a dumb guy.
No. He's a mechanical engineer, and he just started a job, actually, at a boat manufacturing company.
Oh, so cool.
It's very fascinating to hear about. They make big boats, and that's cool. But yeah, so he's able to keep up with and understand a lot of the stuff that I'm working on. But I don't think that he always understands what I'm doing day to day. And so, like, when we first started work, like, moving here, and, like, I think his parents asked, like, what I had to be doing and working on. And he just was like, oh, just, like, answering emails and, like, reading. And, like, that's all you do. And I was just like,
that's really funny.
That's silly.
The other half.
Right. But like, he could tell you my whole master's project. I think that's just like the snapshot of like seeing like what I'm working on day to day, because he wasn't working at the time and I was working from home. So he would just watch me doing work and he didn't really know what it is I was doing. And so it's definitely like a different perspective. But anyway, what I actually do. We finally arrived at it. I'm a PhD student, and I was supposed to be starting under a grant that is funded by the NOAA Restore Funds, which are from the BP oil spill, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
So essentially, BP paid a ton of money, and now they're still funding projects in the Gulf to kind of offset their environmental monstrosities that they did.
Tell you what, they're BP. They sound like pretty good people if they're funding all the science.
Well, they were sued. Like the good guys. They were definitely sued. They did not willingly give that money.
Are you trying to tell me that a large oil company wasn't voluntarily going to fork over millions of dollars for science research?
Nope.
I'm shocked.
Corporation's gonna corporation.
Exactly. Exactly. So the grant that I was supposed to be taken on as basically wanted to start a hard bottom habitat monitoring program and extend a already occurring seagrass monitoring program. So seagrass, it does a whole lot of good stuff, you know, ecosystem functions, they protect the shoreline, they stabilize sediments, their habitat. It's important to monitor the water quality and also the growth, so that way we know when, or potentially when, we're about to have a huge die-off of seagrass. Mm-hmm. So they've been monitoring seagrass in this area, which is the Nature Coast Aquatic Preserve on the Gulf side of Florida for a while, but they wanted to extend, add some more sites, get some more data going. And then also they found that there's these little chunks of hard bottom habitat, which if you try to look up an exact definition, it's kind of hard, but essentially it is a bare patch of limestone bedrock that has a small amount of sediment, small enough where seagrass or other rooting plants cannot grow.
Okay.
So think of them as just a solid piece of rock on the ground, but level with the ground. It's not like, bulging up.
Right, it's not like a little underwater hill or mountain or anything.
No. They can have like some structural complexity and have some boulders or rocks or wood, any sort of debris on them. So these patches can also grow specific things that need hard substrate to flourish. And those things would be sponges, corals, oysters, and sometimes macroalgae. Macroalgae can kind of do both sediment and hard bottom.
Okay.
So,
and macroalgae is things, I know it's not like specifically this, but things like kelp and things like that. Is that
yes.
right?
I do believe, yes, that kelp is a macroalgae. There's a bunch of smaller macroalgaes in Florida. They kind of look like seagrass with like a lot of extra leafy, spirally, structure-y stuff. But there's a whole bunch of them. But yeah, it's not like the green water that you would think of as algae. Like those are microalgae, where you're looking in a river and it's just completely green film over it. That's sort of different.
Yeah, these are the things that like you find in the lake and you call seaweed. Because I don't think there are many aquatic, freshwater, true plants. I think most of them are macroalgae.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you for that example.
Yeah.
So yeah, these recently kind of not discovered, but maybe more relevant, or people started thinking about them more as being potential sources of nutrients or sources of habitat or sources of shoreline protection. someone thought, hey, maybe we should start monitoring these patches too. And so we got a grant. Well, we didn't. My advisors and the Department of Environmental Protection got a grant. And
is that from the federal government?
No, it's from NOAA Restore. So it's from NOAA.
Oh, right. Yeah, you said that.
Mm-hmm. They all got together and kind of wrote this grant proposal and then submitted it to the NOAA Restore grant application. And then they received it. And so now they were able to hire a PhD student with that funding. And that was supposed to be me. But it turns out that I got a Dean's Fellowship.
Okay.
Which means that the department that I applied in would pay for my tuition and annual stipend, which they give you like an annual stipend of money to, you know, live and not have to work another job while you're pursuing your degree.
Living large, I assume?
Oh, yeah. Millions. No, it is just enough. I think it is probably under minimum wage.
That's a good one, Mike.
Yeah. But, yeah, so now it's kind of an unspoken agreement that even though I'm not the hired PhD student on this grant, I'm still going to be doing that, and we'll have some maybe more flexible spending to see if I want to do extra kind of projects within the grant and have some a little more supported funding from that. Where was I going with this?
Flexibility. What you actually do.
Yeah. What do I actually do? So every week I have the choice to work from home or work at my office, but I don't really like to work from home because I end up going to lay down in bed. but I'll do a lot of researching, reading a bunch to kind of get a background, and a lot of thinking. I have to do a lot of thinking every day, thinking about, like, while I'm reading, if there's any questions that I could come up with from the stuff that I'm reading or would be interesting. And then thinking about how it could fit within the grant scope that we're working on. And I think that is really the scope of it at this point. I'm doing probably at least one field day a week, which is a lot more than I would usually do, but I'm trying to get more exposure to the, you know, system I'm going to be working with, because it's so, so much different than Louisiana. And so I'm probably doing one day of fieldwork a week, and then the rest I'm, you know, I'm researching, I'm reading, I'm trying to come up with a plan for when we start this kind of sampling in the spring. And because, like, it's such a broad project, from my understanding, we just need to record some of these measurements and provide them to the person in charge of the grant. I think we have like a sub grant.
Okay.
There's not really much that is required at this point. And so I have the flexibility to come up with whatever questions I want within this scope, if that makes sense, of just monitoring seagrass and hard bottom. So just doing some sort of finding questions about the two habitats and finding things that are new, I guess.
Yeah, that's kind of pretty much how I understood what some of my friends who were doing PhDs in our department when I was doing my master's,
mm-hmm.
where they were just reading constantly. And like, I read a lot when I was doing my master's, but
this is definitely more for me, I would say.
Yeah.
Compared to my master's. I mean, yeah, I imagine, like, I also definitely read a lot in my master's, but now it seems like way more.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then on top of my main project, I also have the flexibility to work on some side projects that I'm interested in. So I'm working on some volunteer work, doing like education outreach. I have the ability through one of my advisors, they do boat trips with high schoolers. They take them out and they do like a trawl and they pull up whatever critters they bring on the boat and talk about organisms. I have not done that yet. And then next week.
That's really cool though.
Yeah, yeah. It's very exciting. I didn't think I got the opportunity as much to do that education outreach in my master's. And partly my own fault because I was pushing to get it done a little quicker.
Right.
But then next week, I'll be going into a classroom of elementary kids, and me and one of my lab mates will be doing like a 30-minute, teaching lesson on some seagrass stuff.
So what Adria said elementary, but there's a large gap between, you know, second graders and sixth graders.
Right. I don't know exactly what grade, which thank you for reminding me because I will definitely ask tomorrow because it will probably make a difference.
That's gonna be an important one. Yeah. Either way, the comparing seagrass to different kinds of pastas, I feel like that's going to go great either way.
Right.
Wait, how could it go wrong?
Oh, did I tell you guys that already? Oh, wait, no, I've just been doing it in my seagrass. That is actually the project that I came up with is, like, I bought a bunch of the different kinds of pastas, and I'm going to, like, paint them green, whatever, and I'm going to have them kind of, like, build their own seagrass habitat, and we're going to bring in some organisms from our field work on Friday and kind of go around the room, talk about like the organisms, and then be like, okay, build a seagrass structure that you think like a pinfish would best camouflage in or something like that.
So I would write down as much of this as you can because...
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Well, because and try to quantify how much they, you know, the kids learn, because I think this could make like a pretty decent poster at a conference or something. Just based on some other like you know, outreach or pedagogy type posters I've seen at, you know, some of the conferences I've been doing the last like couple years. I feel like this would fit in really well with those.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. I still need to test it, but I bought the pasta today, so
nice.
I will be testing it out and seeing how it works. Yeah. So I do that and then help out with the lab work. There's always field work going on. And then I'm also working on finishing up my manuscripts for my master's degree. So I think something that is definitely more common, I would say, is that you're not actually done when you get your degree, if that makes sense. It can be. You can be done. But with field intense projects, often you end up having to publish after you graduate.
Okay. And was that like contingent on some of your funding source?
No, it was. I guess yes. Yes, it was.
Okay.
It's not a hard, like, you have to submit this by this date, but it was like, we're going to supply you funding. Yeah, we're going to supply you funding and a graduate stipend, but you're expected to publish your project.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're okay with that publishing, you know, possibly being after the actual graduation date?
Yes. A lot of times.
What happened if you didn't? Like, you get your degree and then you're like, eh, you know, actually... I'm not going to publish. Like,
some people will do that. Some people can do that, but you end up with a lot of burned bridges.
Okay. So if you do that, you're basically kissing a career goodbye.
Right. I mean, if you get your master's and you're I guess, in some pursuing something else where, no, it doesn't matter if you're publishing this or if you have good terms and references from these people, then yeah, people do that. But if you're planning on continuing your education or continuing in the field that you're working with, it would be very unwise, I would say.
So I will say, just for the record, that's kind of what I did, is that I I didn't have to. So I presented my master's as a talk at a conference. We had a whole episode about it a couple of weeks ago. I didn't have to do that. In fact, I think it's rather uncommon from my particular program. And I don't know if that's just a different in, you know, department culture. You know, my university was quite small, and relatively low pressure compared to some, like an R1 university, which are the universities that throw tons and tons of funding at publishing to get prestige so they can get grants and things like that. I would assume, at least based on how the PhD programs worked at the School of Mines, you're not doing your own active research, especially your first year. You're just doing a lot of background, a ton of reading, but you're not sort of, you're not doing any experiments or any like new research quite yet. And so I think it's just sort of the general expectation that like, hey, maybe go publish your master's while while you're not, you know, actively doing new research. I don't know. I know for sure a couple of my, you know, like lab mates, office mates, whatever, didn't, because they were also teaching and doing, you know, lots of stuff and had summer internships and stuff like that. So, but yeah, so I'm sure that probably is just a difference in academic department culture.
Right. Yeah. And I want to go back to that thing you said about R1. So it helps me think about institutes like divisions of sports, collegiate sports. So you have like D3, D2, D1, where D3 is like a smaller college, D2 is kind of like middle, and then D1 is like, you know, Syracuse basketball, right?
Yeah.
This is for you, Mike.
Appreciate it.
So, yeah, LSU was a D1 school for the research that they do. So it's pretty expected that you publish at least one or two papers out of your master's. And UF is the same. It's an R1 research institution. So they definitely encourage publications. But yeah, I think it all depends too on like if you're brought up on soft money or hard funded money, if there's requirements. Like I was kind of brought on in a very large grant that it was just kind of like you can do whatever you want, really. It just has to involve oysters and biodiversity. So it wasn't necessarily like there were deadlines that these things had to be published by. So it's very loose, but is definitely still.
If you were on like an NSF grant or something.
Yes.
For the non-science folks, a National Science Foundation. So that's money from the federal government. There are a lot of strings attached to that.
Yep.
And there are certain things that you need to do by certain times. And so, for example, I know there's someone in our department writing an NSF grant for a piece of equipment that is, you know, in the ballpark of $1 million. Or at least, you know, a few hundred thousand, you know, for sure. And if they get it, you know, there is the expectation that you are using this so often that it's not just sitting there, which might sound annoying, but you know, if it's, you know, taxpayer money. I appreciate that as someone who pays taxes. So, yeah, where your funding comes from determines a lot about how your science is done.
Yep. So, with that, I come to my final point that I wanted to talk about in PhD science, whatever you want to call this topic, and that is rejection.
Oh boy.
I have never been rejected so much than in science, ecology, ever. it's just normal. Like, it's just the way it goes, because there's a lot of people applying to a small amount of grants and applications and journals, and the ratios aren't always successful. So you just have to be prepared for it.
Yeah.
And it's something that I was taught very early on, but it didn't actually set in until I got my first rejection. And that first rejection was very, very hard.
But, yeah, I remember, off pod, you and I talked about this a little bit when I think you'd probably gotten a couple of rejections at that point.
Yeah.
You were like, is this, or I think I had said it on the podcast that, like, yeah, grant writing, I'm like, if you get, you know, 5 to 10% of the grants you write, you're a phenomenal grant writer.
Exactly.
And I remember you text me and was like, hey, thanks for that.
Yeah, for sure. I really, really did appreciate that. I think I wasn't even part of the podcast yet. I was just listening to your podcast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's super competitive. So for example, right. Like I said, that person in our department writing that NSF grant, our university itself, and granted, we're a pretty small university, but we have to write a little pre-grant to submit it to our university's grant office, and I think they pick only one or two to allow to go out to to NSF per year from the university. So it's like, you're not only competing with you know, everyone else who's sending in an NSF grant, you're competing like within the university to even be able to send it in the first place.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, that first rejection was tough, and the second one probably was too. But it's definitely gotten easier, and I hope like if anyone else is pursuing a career like this, listen to me and believe me when I say that it will get easier, because I never thought it was going to get easier, but it did. And to prove it, I submitted my manuscript for publication, I think, last week. And within like 4 days, it got rejected. And I wasn't upset at all. It didn't hurt me in the slightest bit. I was just like,
Were you expecting it?
No, I wasn't expecting it at all. I thought this was going to be just an easy, like, it's been critiqued, like, by so many people. I've gone through probably 20, maybe 30 revisions, drafts of this paper. And I just thought, you know, like, it's going to have some minor revisions and that's it. But I don't know. I guess I just felt like, you know, I had done the best that I thought. And I knew that if they were rejecting it off the spot like this, then that's okay. There's plenty of other journals. I'll just try again. And I later found out that I guess there's potential that they're going through just a bunch of desk rejections because there's a lot of people publishing right now, and it's just kind of difficult to be publishing in this particular journal right now.
Gotcha.
But yeah, rejection. It's okay. It's going to be okay. So that's all I got. Do you guys have any thoughts or questions or things you might be curious about?
I mean, it definitely just the whole path is, you know, kind of one out of passion. Like, there's not a whole lot of people that are getting rich off of this.
Oh, God.
Oh no. Yeah.
Right. Like, it's, So if this is a path you want to go down, like, please do. We need more good scientists, but making sure you're going in kind of open-eyed with everything.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It always blows my mind when people talk about scientists doing X for the money. And I'm like,
yeah.
Have you ever met a scientist and talked to them for 2 minutes? Because they will tell you how hard it is to get money in science. Like, unless you become someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson or Bill Nye, who do a lot mm-hmm. of science communication and get picked up by some big media thing, that's the only way you make, you know, money in science.
Mm-hmm. And even then, that's science communication, not the actual right. science.
Exactly. And it's like, I don't even know if Neil deGrasse Tyson still teaches, to be honest. I have no idea. Yeah, that's where the only, like, you're not going to become, you know, a multimillionaire by just getting a PhD and teaching at a university and doing research for, you know, 30 years. You're not going to be rich.
Yeah, it's true.
But yeah, I guess I had one question to finish us off.
Mm-hmm.
So how does, you know, this first, you know, semester or you know, not quite semester, compared to like the first semester or so of your master's?
Well, I would say that it's a lot easier.
Yeah. You think so?
It's a lot easier because I am wise now, I feel. I think about this a lot. When I first started, I wanted to just get my PhD, and I didn't want to get my master's because I was like, that's just a waste of time. I'm going to just get my PhD anyway. Like, it's just time. And thinking back on that now, I am very grateful for getting a master's degree first, because it not only prepared me with knowledge in like the science community, but it also helped me in like what to expect emotionally and physically, and I guess kind of the inner workings and underlying things that no one ever teaches you before you get into grad school. And I wish that I had wrote all those things down, because a book of that would be incredible, but I did not. And so now I don't remember them. They're just part of my nature.
Yeah, I definitely sort of second that vibe. Because, yeah. You know, I've talked about it on the show before. I think, you know, fairly early on in the you know, series of episodes here. But, you know, when I started my master's, I fully intended to, you know, do the same thing. Go get a PhD afterward. Although in paleontology, it's very uncommon to just go straight to a PhD. It does happen, but it's a lot less common than in the life sciences. Mm-hmm. So I fully intended to do my 2 years at my master's and then go do my 4 to 6 in a PhD. And then I got actually going into my master's and I was like, I don't know how much I love this. The actual minutia of doing the work. Obviously, right. You know, we're 125 episodes deep. Obviously, I think it's really important.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether it was for me to do for the next give or take 50 years, you know, I just evidently I decided no, it wasn't for me. And so that is definitely not knowledge that I would have had, you know, if I hadn't done a master's. And that would be a horrible thing to realize in the middle of your PhD.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. if you do realize it and you are in your PhD, you should still stop.
Yes, absolutely.
I still believe that, because dealing, yeah.
Like quitting should always be an option. We should talk more right. about how quitting is totally fine.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I definitely, and also like with my master's degree, I was starting my first sampling like within the first couple months, and we're not starting until April. So I have a lot more time now, which I think helps the stress levels.
Awesome. Well, I don't think I have any other last questions or thoughts, and we're brushing up on an hour.
Yep.
So do if you have anybody any closing thoughts for us?
I just was going to say, if any of you listeners have any questions for me that you would like to ask me, please feel free to, I don't know how, but ask me through our show.
YouTube comments or tweets or whatever the heck they're being called now.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Fia, for kind of taking us through that journey. And thank you to all of our listeners for making it through episode 125 of I Wish You Were Dead, a podcast about things that used to be alive. We'll see you in 2 weeks, and until then, take care, everybody.
This episode of I Wish You Were Dead was written by Fenella Campanino and hosted by Gavin Davidson, Mike Bryson, and Fenella Campanino. It was sound edited and edited for YouTube by Gavin Davidson. Special thanks to former guests of the pod and to listeners like you.